STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Well, hello, friends, and happy Christmas to you, this being our final broadcast before Christmas. And I'm looking forward to winding down here shortly and resting with my family, as you are as well, and giving appropriate weight in the midst of all the chaos to the reason for the season, as they say, the significance of God coming to earth, the advent of the Messiah. And I have more things to say about that. I'm going to save them for just a bit, because I want to take a caller, and it's our friend Jordan from Ohio. And Jordan, a happy Christmas to you, sir.
Hey, Merry Christmas.
And do you actually, as an atheist, do you celebrate Christmas? And if you do, what parts do you celebrate?
it's kind of a secular celebration for me, of course. Get the family together, and we appreciate each other's company and
sure,
share food
of course.
And gifts sometimes.
Right. Okay. But now, when you say get the family together, are you married with children, or are you talking about your extended family, your brothers and sisters, and your parents?
Yeah, brothers, sisters, and parents. Yeah.
I see. Okay.
I don't know if I made that point clear. I'm the only atheist in the family. So
okay. Are the rest Christians?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
yeah.
So what's on your mind today? Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, the previous two calls were fun. The first caller sounded like he started his call, reading from some notes, I think, and I took some notes myself.
This caller was the caller about which particular caller are you referring to?
The one that was talking about Messianic Jews.
Yes. Okay. Good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is funny, because my brother actually kind of took an interest in that a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not to say that he identifies as a Messianic Jew, but he does appreciate how they wanted to emphasize the importance of the Torah.
Right. So, usually Messianic Jew is a term that refers to someone who is Jewish who believes that Jesus was the Messiah. And the first 20 or 30 years of Christianity, virtually everybody that was what we now call a Christian, which wasn't what they called themselves, nor did they call themselves Messianic Jews, but they were what we would call now Messianic Jews. That is, that they were Jews who believed that Jesus was the final fulfillment of what the prophets had foretold and the final culmination of God's plan to rescue the world. So the idea of Christianity being Gentile in a certain sense is not theologically sound. Christianity is, in terms of its population, more Gentile than Jewish, but in terms of its theology is actually Jewish. That is, we draw from the Tanakh, the Old Testament, and we see the promise given in the Old Testament to Abraham and then subsequently to the prophets as being the promise of a rescuer who was the person of Jesus of Nazareth, who came to rescue the world, not just the Jews. And so by putting one's faith in Jesus as the Messiah, that is, being messianic, it was just a fulfillment of Judaism. And ironically, that first century, Judaism went in two different directions. The Judaism we have today is not the Judaism of the first century. It's a totally different Judaism, because the temple was destroyed in the first century, and therefore Old Testament Tanakh-type Judaism came to an end. And Judaism went in two different directions. It went into rabbinic Judaism on the one hand, and it went, on the other hand, into Messianic Judaism, which is those that followed Jesus. And many Gentiles embraced Jesus, and so it took on a Gentile character in terms of its demographics, but it still was solidly Jewish with regards to its theology. So when people say, well, Jews don't believe in Jesus, they mean that those who followed the rabbinic tradition after the temple was destroyed, they don't believe in Jesus, but that doesn't mean that no Jews believe in Jesus. A whole bunch of Jews believe in Jesus, believed and do believe. And that's Jesus the Messiah. And so usually those people identify themselves now as Messianic Jews. There are some, I think, kind of odd offshoots of people who call themselves Messianic Jews but still want to hang on to the Torah and use the Torah and practice ancient biblical Judaism. But this is not what Jesus had in mind, and it's not possible to do that anymore because the temple is destroyed, 70 AD, and the temple was the center of the cult of Judaism. I don't mean cult in the pejorative. I mean it's the religious machinations of Judaism were centered in the temple. The temple is destroyed. I think in God's providence it was destroyed for a reason, because God's Messiah was now here and there was no need for that temple. In any event, so that's that's just at no extra charge. So what's on your mind today, Jordan?
Well, actually, now that you bring that up, I have a quick question. My brother took an interest in eating kosher, actually, and I was kind of wondering if he does it as a way of, like, he kind of does it not because he thinks he needs it, but because he thinks it would be pleasing to God. What do you think of that?
No, I don't think that. Jesus said specifically that it is not what goes into a man that defiles him, but what comes out of man. And Jesus, when he said this, he took this as almost self-evident. In fact, he was surprised when his own disciples didn't get it. He said, don't you see? It's not, because he thus declared all foods clean. And he said, don't you see that eating something can't make you bad? There's no moral consequence to food that goes in and is eliminated. It goes through you and goes out. It's what comes out of a man. It's the thefts and the fornications and the sorceries and the idolatries. That is what, as he put it, defiles a man. So yeah. I don't agree with your brother in this regard. If he wants to eat kosher, he's welcome to do that. Nothing is to be denied if it's taken with thanksgiving. That's another New Testament a principle. You know, it's all made for our enjoyment. So why not enjoy it within its proper within its proper boundaries, you know. So, eating certain foods is not going to please God. Not eating certain foods is not going to please God. God doesn't care about the diet in that sense.
Right. Okay. I might have him listen to this later then.
All right. Well, I mean, I know sometimes people will say, well, aren't we the temple of the Holy Spirit? Our bodies are the temple of the Spirit. And it says that in 1 Corinthians. But when you read the context, Paul isn't talking about the food we eat. He's talking about the behaviors that we participate in particular sexual sin. And so what we don't do is take the temple of God and use it to participate in immoral activity. He's not talking about whether we're eating pizza or not. He's because if that were the case, if having a bad diet somehow defiled the temple, then any time anyone was sick for any reason, the temple would be defiled. Paul's not talking about our physical health or well-being at all in there. Physical exercise profits little, he says, referring to the benefit it brings to the physical body. He said, but godliness is a means of great gain, for it holds a promise not only for this life, but for the life to come. And you see, there's a parallel principle there in Paul's comment, as we see with Jesus. It's not what goes into you that defiles you, it's what comes out of you. It's the character, it's not the food. It's the soul, it's not the physical body.
Okay.
So the reason you called, though, has something to do with relationship with God.
Yeah, it's a kind of a continuation of what we've talked about before.
Okay.
You previously mentioned that you trust God much like you trust your wife. There's some commonalities between, you know.
There's some parallels between those kinds of relationships, yeah.
between your relationships there. And so, like, you know, you said, if you ask your wife if she loved you, you know, she would, you would trust that she would say yes.
Well, and, yeah, okay. There was more to that conversation than just that, but okay, we'll just go with that for the moment.
Yeah. So that just, yeah, kind of relates to where I'm going. But so you trust your wife in a lot of ways, and some of those ways that you trust her would even be explicit expectations, like marriage vows, right?
Right. Let me put it this way. This is a better way of putting it. There are things that I know about my wife that informs my trusting of her in a variety of different ways. Let's put it that way. There are things that I know about my wife. Now, I know them in, well, I'll just leave it at that for a moment, and you go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of came up with a short list of, like, generic ways that you trust her, much like anyone else would. Since she is your wife, you trust her to care for you and your children, and therefore you trust her not to intentionally do harm or abandon you.
Right, and, right, right. I expect that she will keep the promise that she's made to me because she's trustworthy. And so I have entrusted myself to her. That was my vow to her, giving myself to her in marriage, was entrusting myself to her. Okay, she wasn't a stranger at that time. I made a dedication of my life to her in relationship, and certain things generally follow from that kind of dedication. Now, people who are married, and you're single, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. People who are married know that it doesn't always work out the way you planned. In fact, let me put it this way, and I'm not talking about myself here, I'm talking about marriage. It never works out the way you plan. It never works out the way you plan it. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying it's different. And nobody knows what will be the consequence of that intimate relationship until they're in it. You can plan, you can expect, you can hope, you can all these other things, but it turns out that being intimately related to another fallen human being makes demands upon our lives that none of us could properly expect before we get married. And every person who's listening to this who is married knows exactly what I'm talking about. You have one picture when you walk down the aisle, and then you live life. And it turns out to be different. And this is as God intended it. All I'm saying is that there are things about life in our most intimate relationships that we can't possibly have a full understanding of what will result and what it entails and what demands are made. This is true in our relationship with God. We realize we need Him. We're desperately guilty. We bend our knee, we beat our breasts, we say, God, have mercy on me, a sinner, and God does. And we return home to our Father from our far country, and we enter His embrace, and we start to be a son of His, or a daughter, as the case may be. But then what is on the horizon? Boy, that's a whole nother story. God knows, but we don't. There are some themes there, but the details, the particulars, are a mystery to each of us. And we enter into that adventure of walking with God through thick and through thin.
Okay. I've got some more examples.
Why don't you tell me what your point is or the question, and then we'll work on that. Because I think I generally understand how the examples work, but your point or your question would be what? Where are we going with this?
The pattern I wanted to kind of show in my examples is that, like, when it comes to trust, there's two sides to it. You know, there's a positive expectation and a negative one, kind of. And, you know, it's that idea of trust can be betrayed, or, you know, expectations may not be met.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you say something is true, you're simultaneously saying that it's not false, you know, that type of thing.
Correct.
And so that is my attempt to frame what I'm looking for.
Okay.
With God. And if God is real and he hears my prayers, but he chooses not to respond in any way that I ask him to, am I not justified in doubting that he wants a relationship with me?
Well, okay, that's just dealing with the last part there. I can see how that would raise a question. If you turn to God and ask him for something and he doesn't give you what you want, I can see how it could raise the question in your mind that maybe God doesn't want to have a relationship with you. But you know what? You know when you take a sampling in a, say, a survey to try to come to a conclusion about something? You know what they mean by a small sampling?
It's not representative. Is that
what
you're going to
say? It's not statistically relevant, right? If you take too small of a sampling, you may not come to the proper conclusion. So you may be trying to assess God and his desire to have a relationship with you based on one thing, particular prayer requests that you have that may not have been answered. But I don't think that strikes me as the wrong sampling size. For one, that might be like walking up to a strange woman and asking favors of her that are only appropriate for a particular kind of relationship. All right? She's not going to give you what you're asking for, and I don't mean necessarily sexual. I'm just saying just in general.
Right.
There are certain favors we ask of people that are the province of a particular relationship. You don't ask the favors to begin relationship. The favors are a result of relationship that's already established. And if you ask for these things, you are really asking out of turn. So when you go to God for things, you may be relying on him to treat you like a son when, in fact, you are acting in your life like a rebel. And God isn't going, he has no obligation to treat you like a son when you're not a son.
Okay.
Not everybody is a child of God in the sense that we're talking about. Being a child of God in the sense we're talking is a particular kind of relationship that gets entered into, just like marriage is a particular kind of relationship that gets entered into. And once one enters into that.
Say that, you know, someone's not yet aware that God wants that relationship. And it's not that they, you know, are conscious of the fact that they disobeyed him, but they're just told that God is interested, and then they make that request at that point. Like, would God not reach out then, or
Well, if you're saying the request or the prayer that you're making is that you want to know whether God is real and whether a relationship with him is a real possibility, I think people have prayed. I know that people have prayed that prayer. I prayed that prayer in the summer of 1976. And many people like me before I was a Christian, and I asked God to show himself to me in some fashion, in some form. No, I didn't make a peculiar demand. Okay, write a sign for me in the sky or something like that. I just said, show me and help me to see this. And it was a genuine appeal to God. And all kinds of things began happening in my life that became more and more evident to me that God was, in a certain sense, reaching out to me. Now, I still had to respond to him, and I did that ultimately.
Hey, Greg? The way you described that, the way you found, the way that you believe that God revealed himself to you, do you see a problem with that?
No. If I saw a problem with that, I wouldn't have thought it was relevant.
Because what I see is the risk of confirmation bias, of counting the hits and ignoring the misses.
Well, look, I don't know how to respond to that entirely. God is a person, okay? And I mean, if he is God, then he is a person. He's a personal being in that sense, and that and mm-hmm. that he has a will. And he and if he is God, then he's the ruler of the universe. He is the sovereign to whom I'm beholden. And so when I ask for an audience, I have to get an audience on his terms. Just because he doesn't jump through every single hoop that I want him to jump through doesn't mean he isn't real, okay? And so I'm not adding these things up like the hits and the misses. Well, he didn't jump through that. Those five hoops, so that's five misses. Now here's a hit. Then he did jump through that hoop or he did respond to that, so that's one. Well, that's 5-1. He's still losing. It's not the way you deal with – that isn't the way you make these kinds of decisions, okay?
Okay.
Do I have good reason to believe – that a personal God exists? I have a multitude of good reasons, and we talk about them all the time here on the show. And you've been listening long enough to know about these things, and you know I have had those conversations. Is it reasonable, and we've talked about this, that this God who does exist might want to be in relationship with us? And you agreed with me, yes, that seemed like reasonable in principle. And then I said, and this is how we ended one of our conversations, maybe the last one, well, then maybe we should be casting about where God might have revealed that interest or that attempt to be in relationship with us. Now, the answer to that is that God seems to, or at least there is a claim to such a thing in the Bible and through the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And so we can look more directly at that and see if we have good reasons to take those things seriously. Back 43 years ago and of some months, in the summer of 1973, I was pondering all these issues, okay? And I was asking all these questions. And I got to a point of saying, okay, I'm not going to just play academic anymore with this. I'm not just going to just, you know, see about the hits and misses. I'm going to get existentially involved in this. God, are you there? Because other people say you are. And if you are, I want to know. That's it. That was my prayer. And there was no coconuts falling from the trees and lightning and, you know, nothing like that happened. It was just a guy praying. It was maybe the first real prayer I ever prayed. But then as time went on, things just happened. And I can't, it isn't like, you know, spirits appeared to me or bread multiplied miraculously in a basket or anything like that. But I just began to have an awareness of God showing up and this message that I had been encountering becoming more and more persuasive, more and more believable. And I didn't even have at my disposal the kinds of things that you have, Jordan, just through a radio show like this one. There weren't radio shows like this one. There weren't all of this robust conversation in the public square about reasons for God and for the resurrection. I mean, there were books like that, but it wasn't anything like it is now. You have at your disposal things I never had at my disposal. Okay, so you have all the more reason to take seriously the claim that God is real and Jesus is his son and the savior of the world. The question you need to ask yourself is whether you're going to personally invest yourself in this or not. And I need to go to break here, so I'm just going to leave this parting shot for you to think about over Christmas, okay? Is that all right with you, Jordan?
Well, I was going to say, I wanted to mention that I actually asked my brother to take a test or perform a test for God, and he said that he had no doubt that God would pass it, but then he refused to actually do it.
Well, I can't answer for your brother, but I will speak about the tests, okay? God has no obligation to jump through any hoops that we put out there for him to prove his existence or his willingness to be involved with us. There's an old saw about some professor who said, if God exists, he'll catch this chalk. He'll keep it from hitting the floor. And then he puts it out and he drops it and it shatters in the floor. And he concludes, therefore, God doesn't exist. Well, it's a silly test because the simple way to show that it's false is I could stand up before that professor and say, okay, professor, do the same thing, drop the chalk. And if I exist, I'll catch the chalk. And then he drops the chalk and it shatters on the floor. And then I say, well, I guess I don't exist, do I? Well, it's obvious that I do exist. I just had no interest in catching his chalk. And this is the problem with all of those kinds of tests. If we're going to ask God to jump through hoops, he may jump through the hoop. He may not. But if he doesn't, that doesn't mean he doesn't exist. It just means that he is not a circus animal who's going to jump through every hoop that we offer for him.
I guess my objection then would be that he doesn't actually trust God to pass the test, though.
Well,
in that case.
Well, that's one way of putting it. Or you could say he doesn't presume that God is going to respond to his request, nor should he. I don't think it's an issue of trust. Okay, here's my test, God. Strike lightning right now here in, right next to the ground of the office right here. Bang! Do you trust God to do it? No, I don't trust him to do that. I don't count on him to do that because I have no reason to think that he will. So I don't trust him to do it, but that's no shortcoming of God's. Listen, here's what I want you to think about. All right, Jordan, and I got to run. What I want you to think about is just what I said about myself 40 years ago or so, 43 years ago, in that summer of 1973, where I moved from being kind of academic discussions to a genuine personal existential quest, putting myself in the line and asking God, are you really there? If you are, I want to know you. That was a turning point for me. We've had lots of really good discussions. I love them, and I hope we have more. But my
I did something similar, actually.
Okay.
And it was a turning point for me, too.
Okay, good. Well, that's
good. But I went in the other direction.
Well, all right. All right. Well, I don't know what to say to you then. It feels like our discussions are academic, which is all right, but academic discussions ultimately aren't going to get you far. It feels like you're not personally engaged in a way that matters. But I could be mistaken about that. I'm just passing that on to you. In any event, Jordan, I hope you have a great Christmas with your family.
Merry Christmas, Greg.
And I hope you sing some Christmas carols that are spiritual and pay attention to the words, all right?
Sure.
All the best to you, brother. All right, friends. Let's go quickly to break, and then I have a couple of thoughts on Christmas that I'll share with you before I close the show. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's mentoring letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STR e-news from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on Subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
I have been working on one of the most important projects of my life for over a decade now, and it's finally come to press. It's called The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. Now, The Story of Reality is a kind of a wide-angle view of the Christian story. It's a big-picture description of the meaning of the drama of human history. And it's meant to cover the basics of Christianity from a worldview perspective, in a voice that's really conversational, not religious. It's kind of a mere Christianity for a new generation, if that comparison doesn't seem too bold. Now, I tell the story using five words that capture the meaning of all of human history from its beginning to its end: God, man, Jesus, cross, and resurrection. The narrative, it's infused with what I call a kind of soft apologetics, that is, thoughtful reflections that are not argumentative, but rather are friendly appeals to common sense notions we're all aware of that point to the truthfulness of the Christian story. I think you'll find The Story of Reality to be, as Lee Strobel put it, a beautifully crafted description of the Christian worldview written in an accessible, winsome, and well-reasoned manner. All right, friends, final segment of our show here, and what I like to do, and boy, I think I've been doing this for maybe 15 years or so, is to end with a couple of reflections that I got from actually secular sources that have always been meaningful to me. to focus my thinking regarding Christmas. One comes from the LA Times from the 14th of December, 2003, and the other one comes from a Cal Thomas column, but he's actually citing Harry Reasoner on Christmas Eve, 1973. Harry Reasoner, news commentator from secular station long ago. And both of them, I think, are great ways to end the season, the year, this reflection going into Christmas. Now, I've talked in the past about films that have been meaningful to me at Christmas time, and there's a whole bunch of them that you may watch. But there are two that I think are the most significant classical films about Christians, about Christmas. I have recently talked a bit about the newer film, The Nativity, which to me is the single best Christmas film available because it does talk about the birth of Jesus. It's the whole accounting of it, and it's very well done, and it's very consistent with Scripture. And it, anyway, I've mentioned that before. But the two that are the most significant classical films, in my view, are the films that portray the wonderful. It's a Wonderful Life. And the film I was the reason I'm pausing is because the film that I'm referring to is Scrooge, but it's a characterization of the Christmas Carol done by Alistair Sim in 1951, which I think is the best characterization or the best rendition of it. And here in this article, Andrew Clavin in the LA Times in a piece titled "Eternity Is Now: Just Ask Scrooge and George Bailey," Clavin offers, I think, a very fruitful and thoughtful reflection on these two movies. I guess the best thing to do is just read a portion of his column here that has the important part in it. And here's what he offers. One thing that's always struck me, he writes, about these two films is that they're essentially mirror images of each other. In Scrooge, that would be the Christmas Carol version of 1951, in Scrooge, a man grown rich because of heart-shriveling greed is forced by spirits to view the consequences of his existence. In It's a Wonderful Life, George Bailey, a man of financial trouble because of his large-souled generosity, is forced by an angel to view the consequences of his non-existence. What would have happened if he'd never been born? On both sides of the mirror, the results are the same, a revolutionary personal transformation, what the New Testament calls metanoia, which is often translated as repentance, but which means literally a change of mind. After the metanoia, there's a lot of Christmas caroling and happiness and that sort of thing. Thus, movie critics who frequently confuse darkness with depth sometimes belittle these films as sentimental. They're wrong. Watched carefully, the films are disturbingly realistic, because for each protagonist, the change in outlook has absolutely nothing to do with the change in circumstance. They aren't singing carols or so forth because they've won the girl or beaten the villain or made millions or righted wrongs. Scrooge can never bring justice to the people he's ruined, and Bailey will never become the world-traveling architect he wanted to be. And yet, in the aftermath of their visions, both men are joyous. "I don't deserve to be so happy," Scrooge mutters, "but I can't help it." And Bailey lets out a heartfelt, "Yay!" when the angel returns him to the dreary town that has been the graveyard of his ambitions. Scrooge and George Bailey, in traveling through misery to see the eternal born in time, are descendants of those wise men who traveled through the wilderness to see God born into history. To such a vision, amid failure and sin, and even in the face of death, there is only one response: yay. That Andrew Clavin, "Eternity Is Now," I've thought about that much, that comparison. They're mirror images of each other, these two wonderful films. And again, in neither case does the resolution entail circumstances changing in their lives, but rather a change in outlook. Think about that. And here the final reading from Christmas Eve 1973. The author is Harry Reasoner. Here's what he has to say. Christmas is such a unique idea that most non-Christians accept it and, I think, sometimes envy it. If Christmas is the anniversary of the appearance of the Lord of the universe in the form of a helpless baby, it's quite a day. It's a startling idea, and the theologians, who sometimes love logic more than they love God, find it uncomfortable. But if God did do it, he had a tremendous insight. People are afraid of God and standing in his very bright light, but everyone has seen babies and almost everyone likes them. So if God wanted to be loved as well as feared, he moved correctly here. And if he wanted to know people as well as rule them, he moved correctly, because a baby growing up learns all there is to know about people. If God wanted to be intimately a part of man, he moved correctly, for the experience of birth and familyhood is our most intimate and precious experience. So it comes beyond logic. It's what a bishop I used to know called a kind of divine insanity. It is either all falsehood, or it is the truest thing in the world. It is the story of the great innocence of God, the baby God, in the power of man. And it is such a dramatic shot toward the heart that if it is not true, then for Christians, nothing is true. So, even if you did not get your shopping all done and you were swamped with the commercialism and frenzy, be at peace. And even if you're a deacon having to arrange extra seating for all the Christmas Christians that you won't see until Easter, be at peace. The story stands. It's all right that so many Christians are touched only once a year by this incomparable story, because some final quiet Christmas morning the touch will take. Well, that's Harry Reasoner's thoughts about Christmas. It's a great ending for our show. If this is not true, for Christians, nothing is true. But as it turns out, the story stands. I like that. Thank you, friends, for a wonderful year. I look forward to 2017 with you. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Happy Christmas, and give them heaven. Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.